Welcome to the Max Finance Podcast, where a certified financial planner and personal finance geek discuss how to make intentional financial decisions that maximize your money and achieve your goals. Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Max Finance Podcast. Today, we are continuing our conversation with real estate, and this time talking more about our personal stories around real estate, maybe different elements we talked about in our last episode, some things that you could think about or should think about as you purchase a home. But were those the sorts of things that we went through, or I guess more to the point, not to spoil it, but what I went through as I went and bought a couple of pieces of property. Maybe we start this episode talking about like how we thought about the different times of whether it made sense to rent or consider purchasing at various points in our lives. Do you want to kick us off, Lauren? Was there ever a time when you're pretty darn close to pulling the trigger on purchasing something?
Sure. I don't think there were times that I was close, but there were times when I considered it. But there were definitely some unique circumstances that surrounded them. So I think the first time that came up was, I think it was around 2012, 2013. I had recently just moved back to San Francisco from living abroad. I was living in the Philippines at the time. And I had just recently got a job back here in San Francisco. And at the time, I guess, let's see, where was I living at that point? I think when I first moved back, I lived with my parents for a few months while I was looking for an apartment myself. There is, in San Francisco exists a particular program called Below Market Rate. They both have rentals as well as homes that you can purchase. And they're available for people who make under a particular income threshold. So typically it's like maybe 100% of the median income or something like that. So, you know, 2013, I was very early in my career and I just kind of qualified for that. And so I learned about that program and kind of completed all the things that you need to do that. And kind of, you kind of apply for a lottery and essentially. And so anyway, that was my first experience sort of running some numbers in terms of is it beneficial to buy versus rent? And I guess it's not a huge surprise, but in this circumstance, you know, if you can buy a home that's maybe a quarter of the market rate, turns out it actually can be a pretty good investment. Even with some of the strings attached, such as you can never rent it out, and actually you don't really even get to sell it for more than you purchased it, with the exception of inflation, I believe, basically. So if, you know, if inflation was 3% over the last 5 years and you sell it, you can only sell it for that price. So that's one time that I did this, and maybe later we can talk about another time. But essentially, you know, what I did was I created a big spreadsheet and I calculated sort of like what are all my different assumptions, and how much would it cost me, like month by month. So if I was renting, this is how much I would spend. And then if I was buying a house and at this month I had decided to sell it, this is how much I would end up spending the house. So essentially you can kind of see like at what point does buying the house, like usually the first month renting, you're always going to be ahead, because the first month if you bought that house, you paid these kind of fixed costs and stuff. But pretty soon, depending on all the different inputs, there will be a time where it's kind of a break-even point where, okay, you would kind of spend the same amount of money buying versus renting. And that could be, you know, again, depending on all the assumptions. I think for this one, it was actually very short, maybe 12 months or something like that, which is not typical. And I think something we talked about maybe on our last episode, that's oftentimes not for, you know, 5 years out, maybe even 10 years out. But you can kind of see what kind of scenario you come out ahead and how big the difference is, right? Because I think, you know, one might be more financially advantageous, but if it's not a huge difference, then, you know, then you can really let the other factors make that decision. So So yeah, that was one area that I think I learned a lot about. I think the different costs of owning a house, not that I have experience with them, but just researching and understanding the different costs there, and thinking about how those costs kind of stack up month by month.
So tell me about a little bit, I know you're probably not the expert in this particular program, but I'm curious about it. So it's just based on a lottery system. And so it's just the random roll of the die, whether or not you're going to get your name called, or how does, like, do you?
Pretty much. So they make you go through a workshop program to make sure you understand the program. You have to go through, I think that's basically it. You have to prove some documents to prove that your income, prove that you're a resident, for instance. As properties become available, so typically like a new development has to, set aside 15 or 20% of its units. If all these rules, if it's greater than, X number of units, they have to set aside 15% of the units for this below market rate program, for instance. So as a unit is sort of announced, there's a period for people who can qualify to submit an application. And then there's a lottery where they just literally, it's like a bingo thing. They take this, you get assigned a number or something, and then they pull these numbers out. And
is this like televised or like recorded or webinar or something?
I wish. I don't know. I think they do it in person. I didn't attend. I only actually applied to one. Like, you have to like submit an application packet for every building, essentially. Okay. And it's quite a lot of work, actually, unfortunately. So I only ever did one. And then pretty quickly, my income actually grew that I no longer qualify. But yeah, they draw a lottery, and it's kind of like they create a list, like a queue, because essentially they don't really review all of the documents and eligibility until you've actually are high up there. So I think like there's a good chance that maybe if there's only 10 units, but you're number 20, you might actually get one of the units because someone ahead of you maybe actually doesn't meet the requirements or for whatever reason. So I think I remember I was like, I don't know, place 200 or something. I think there were, I think there were like 20 units available or 15 units available. And I was like placed over 100 or something. So it wasn't even close.
And the lottery just puts you in order. Like they'll go down the line.
And then they go down the line and they check each person's eligibility requirements, and presumably they have to like make some sort of financial commitment. And if they are in, then they're in, and they'll keep doing that until they have no more units available or something like that. But okay. That was 2013. I don't know if they've changed. I would hope that they would have simplified it a little bit, because assembling all these documents and stuff every single time a building came up seems it was a bit arduous of a process. But each building is different, and the prices are different, and they have different features and locations. So I can understand, but it was definitely a long process. But learned a bit about just kind of home ownership and costs. Primarily, these are all about condos. They're not single family homes.
And was there, let's say you were one of the lucky few, do you have like a certain down payment size that you need, or they'll take care of everything? Obviously recognizing that you're in a high cost of living city and maybe not earning under a certain threshold.
Yeah, I don't remember that the program provided any of these things. I'm looking at my like notes here, and I have all these acronyms here. So there's some down payment assistance programs that you could also just avail of being a California resident. So they kind of told you about these programs. So I think you could make a down payment as small as like 3% or 5% maybe. But yeah, I don't remember that something special to the city. I think that was just something that was available to California residents who, again, also made less than the certain threshold for income. So yeah, there's two different programs. I don't know. I have them as acronyms right now. I don't know what they were exactly. But down payment wasn't huge.
I got you. Yeah, that's what I would imagine. And presumably these loans are made to the city or the county or something like the local municipality.
The loan's in your name. Loan's in your name.
But it's backed by those institutions rather than a bank, or were those actually through banks? And it's like, okay, we're going to back you because the loan is a little bit less because you're buying this property at a much lower price point.
I mean, so I guess, yeah, maybe put some numbers to it. So the building that I was looking at, this was like kind of on for those who know San Francisco, it's Van Ness and Clay or something. Kind of a pretty nice area. I guess technically Knob Hill-ish, maybe. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, obviously a new building. And I think there was two options. They had both two bedrooms and one bedrooms. The two bedrooms were about $240,000. And the one bedroom was $210,000. I think, you know, the market rate for those units were, you know, I think probably over $1 million for the two bedroom. And I think maybe a little bit less for the one bedroom. Roughly like a quarter, I think, or so of what the market rate was. Now the HOA fees were still those weren't prorated or discounted at all. That's something that you still have to pay as a below market rate tenant. The loan is just way smaller. So I believe that you would get the loan through a normal lender.
Bank. Yeah.
But you got some assistance for the down payment through like another some other program or something like that that you had to pay back when you, I guess, sold the property or paid it back over time. I don't recall, to be honest, all those little details about the down payment assistance. But I just remember, I mean, it was the payback period was very, very short. It was months, like not even a year.
Oh, wow. Wow. Yeah, I think I recall just kind of looking back at some of the clients I've had, they've in various cities have had something similar to that, like you're saying, where it caps the amount, you can't have renters, it caps the amount of appreciation that you'd actually, and do these, are these just like a continual pool of available? So let's say you sold it, you'd be selling it to somebody that might be part of that program as well. You think
you can only sell to somebody as part of the program?
Okay. So an inventory of housing for lower income folks.
Right, right. So that is an option too to buy. Is you can try to find ones that come up for sale as well. But I think it's kind of rare that they come up for sale. You know.
Yeah, I would imagine. Why would you leave?
Because the price is so low, and you know the property tax is also very low as well. Then it's not a lot of secondhand ones that come up on the market.
Gotcha. And stepping back, do you come from a family that is really big into real estate and like everybody's, it's kind of ingrained on, you know, upon you to, you got to own real estate, you got to have it?
That's a good question. I think so, actually. It's kind of hard to say because I don't know that, you know, I only have one family, but yes, I actually think so. My grandfather, he moved to the United States when he was, I don't know exactly how old he was, maybe his mid-30s or something like that. So he moved from Taiwan, and then soon after brought his family over, which was my mom and stuff. And very quickly, as soon as he could, he borrowed money from some of his friends and family that were in the area to buy property. So that was something
from friends and family to pay cash and buy a property outright.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
So my grandfather owned several pieces of property over the time, probably three or four pieces of property in San Francisco. I think that's something that he did pretty well on. My parents also, you know, they bought, a condo very early on, which is actually something that my grandfather designed, I guess you could say. Like, it also didn't, but yeah, I guess developed it. This is and it was like a 4-unit condo and sold one unit to each of his children.
And a real estate developer.
Yeah, sort of. He was a structural engineer and then also, developed some properties as well.
Nice.
So then my parents owned that and they had some experience buying some properties that they rented. They're kind of firm believers in buying property. And so they've always, mostly my dad has always been an advocate and always telling me and my wife to buy property because he's done well for them. But I do think, you know, it's a bit of potentially a different time now than, you know, 40 years ago in terms of the payback period and the economics, as well as like, you know, they have lived basically in San Francisco. Well, they recently, maybe 20 years ago, or not 20, I guess, 10 years, 15 years ago, moved to Marin County where we live now. But, you know, they lived in basically one place for 20, 30 years. Now they lived in the last place for 15 years. So they don't move around a lot. Whereas, you know, over the last, 15 years, I've moved like 3 or 4 times or something like that. And we plan on moving again kind of soon. So I think there's just kind of a difference there and how much time we plan to spend in one place.
And for those that aren't familiar with the area, and maybe they're more familiar with East Coast, I don't know if you've ever been to Westchester, but is Marin equivalent to, you know, kind of Manhattan's, you maybe live or rent in the city in New York, and then you go live in Westchester, in that area. It's Marin's, I think, kind of the equivalent, where I'm sure a Bay Area all around, but you know, there's some really nice homes, I think, especially in the North Bay.
Yeah, I mean, it's a suburb, definitely. Definitely a lot of people that live here and, you know, maybe commute to the city for work. But I think it's kind of common for a lot of folks who live in San Francisco for work when they want to raise a child and they want more space, or a single family home, they want a backyard or something that is a little more rare in San Francisco, that they will often move outside of San Francisco. So it could be north, could be to the East Bay, could be south, just really anywhere outside of San Francisco. And there's other reasons too. I think like public schooling can also be a reason as well. San Francisco has a very unique public schooling system that's basically like a lottery. So you don't really go to the school in your district, so you don't really know what your child's going to go to. People don't like that uncertainty. So moving north and or south is a good way to solve that. And I'm sure there are places in the East Bay as well that have good public schools too.
Yeah, so I guess it's very safe to say that real estate ownership and owning your home or multiple homes runs in the family. And so you have broken that streak, but very intentionally so, keeping it very focused on the numbers and running spreadsheets and so forth. But do you think if you did hit that lottery that you'd probably be in that below market rate home?
Yes, no question. Will we still be there now? I don't know. That's hard. It's like we call it kind of golden handcuffs, right? Where like you don't really want something anymore, but the money is too good to leave, or the discount is too good to leave. I mean, certainly, yeah, we lived in San Francisco for 8 years. And so, I don't think there's any question we would have lived there. It was great location, really nice condo. So I think, by the way, like when I did this calculation of rent versus buying, I was comparing it to spending $2,100 a month, which is kind of a budget I had set aside for a one bedroom, apartment or something like that. When in fact, actually, we ended up, you know, having a roommate in a two bedroom for a little while before we ended up taking over the whole two bedroom. I think, I guess the question is, you know, if we ended up getting a one bedroom and then we had our daughter. Nah, probably not, actually. I don't think we would have sacrificed that much. If we were able to get the two bedroom, then yeah, certainly. Because, you know, we live in a two bedroom now. But, you know, we did decide to move outside of the city a few years ago to be, you know, for a variety of reasons, a little more space, warmer weather, be closer to my parents. And so it's tough. Yeah, maybe we would have, maybe we would have stayed there and still be there today. It's hard to say. What's kind of unique about this is, like, yeah, you can keep it for as long as you want. I think you can pass it down through to your children as well.
Oh, wow.
I believe, yeah. Your children can live there as long as, you know, but yeah, you can't sublet it. You can't, obviously, probably can't Airbnb it. What was the other interesting kind of caveat about it?
And if you initially qualified, and then let's say your income,
right,
you don't have to continually requalify.
No, and it doesn't matter. So, in some ways, I might have a little guilt, you know, because we really don't, you know, it's not, the program's not designed for us anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, it's designed for people who, at the time, the limit was like $75,000 for a two person household. And so I was considering including Anna in that. But yeah, now we make well over that. And so, you know, I would feel a little guilt, like, you know, you taking up the space in this unit. Whereas if and when we moved out, it would become available for someone who would qualify right now. Mm-hmm. I don't know if how we would have felt about that. That is something to consider.
Yeah, that's a good point. that's definitely a good point. Yeah, there's a reason behind that that program. So, and limited supply, as you say. I mean, how many developments are out there, and how many people are actually cycling through that program?
And yeah, so, not many, not many, not nearly enough of these to satisfy all the demand.
Yeah, yeah. Very cool. Very cool. I'm trying to think, you know, when I personally, for me, when we were considering the rent versus buy. So out of college, I mean, in college, definitely renting, and then out of college, still renting. But I was only renting for like about a year, maybe, if that. Yeah, maybe a year or so.
Only a year after college, and then you decided to buy a place?
Yeah, yeah. I wish I, you know, had made some good stock bets or something like that, or had some crypto. But no, frankly, I had some help from my family for the down payment. So I was very fortunate, and definitely in a similar situation. Not to the extent that, you know, my parents and my family live in Arizona. So it's a much different world. There was a seemingly endless supply of housing. So, you know, you just have to find you could virtually find a home that you can buy for any budget. That's just a matter of how far away from the city center you want to be. I guess that's true anywhere, but it's more so in Arizona, when it's just, you know, you can go in all directions and you're not constrained. So yeah, I just, for me, it was not that long. And then from there we moved to San Francisco. And so that's obviously, that was got thrust into that market. And so we were renting and never bought a home there. That's a much different world.
So going back to your first home purchase, was that something that you wanted to do and thought was important, and you asked your parents for help, or was it something that they just kind of offered? Like, where did the idea to come to buy a house? Because I still think that's pretty unusual for a person just out of college to do that. You know, so I'm just curious as to where that came from.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, they always. I mean, all of my family members were so pro homeownership, and I would imagine, just blanket statement here, that's probably a lot of folks that you know, hey, if you can own a home, you know, that's a really investing in yourself, and so I was very fortunate that my grandpa paid for my college cost, and so the monies that my parents had for me for college was going to be just like, all right, well, you know, we'll help you out if you want to buy a home. And so it's not like I went and bought this gigantic house in Arizona, but it's just it's a 2-bedroom, 1-bath, which basically is almost like a one-bedroom, 1-bath, because it's got just like a little office, little den, and it's about less, just a hair shy of 1,000 square feet. So nothing crazy. In terms of location, I always when I was in college, I'd always drive up to, I'm not sure if you're familiar with the area, but I always drive up to Scottsdale, which is a nicer part of the valley. You got Phoenix, and then you have all of these different suburbs around it, and different cities. And so that was a nicer part of town, especially the north part of that. So, you know, that to me, for whatever reason, when I was having big exams or whatever, I would just take a drive up there, and it's like, oh man, I want to live around here. I just want to live around here. It had some of it's kind of weird, because if you don't know of Arizona, but not every house has got like desert landscaping and like big saguaros all over the place. A lot of them just look like regular houses that, you know, model homes that have just been duplicated and master plan communities and stuff like that. So in this particular area, it had a lot of more of the natural desert landscaping, and there was like a nice mountain kind of area there. So that always attracted me. So I knew that's kind of the area that I really wanted to purchase in. I was constrained by, okay, well, here's my income, and here's, you know, I'm not making that much out of college, and here's the gift that I was given, and, you know, just try to find something that's within the budget. So, it wasn't immediate. I mean, there's definitely a lot more supply, even at my lower end of the budget, but there's a lot, and they all, you know, the ones that were in my budget were like built in the mid 90s. You know, again, kind of under that, you know, maybe you get a 2.2, maybe it's kind of creeping just north of 1,000 square feet. I ended up buying a condo, so it's got an HOA. So for whatever reason, I even then I was thinking about like, I'm not going to be, and this isn't my forever home. I'm probably just going to use this as a rental. So I knew that that was another component. Again, just being out of college, I didn't go so far and do all the number crunching that you had done to say, okay, well, what do rents look like out these days? And, you know, what is the total? It's just like, hey, can I make this payment? Okay, great. It looks good. And yeah, that's kind of how I ended up selecting it. I mean, there was a lot of supply. It was just a matter of like, oh man, I need to find one that has all of the, I'm trying to get the best one that I can, whether it be aesthetics or upgrades and whatnot.
So I'm curious, when you bought, so you said you didn't like run a lot of numbers or spreadsheets. Mm. Had you thought about like how long you were planning to live there? This was in Arizona. Yes. Yeah, so how long had you lived there? Or I guess you moved back there after school, or like, I guess you're familiar with the area, I guess. You went to school around that area, I guess you said, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's ASU, Arizona State.
And so, yeah, I guess, did you have a concept of how long you were planning to live there? Was it like, yeah.
Good question.
In the situation?
Yeah, I didn't think I was going to live there for a super long time. Maybe 10 years is kind of what my thoughts were. And then I'd save up enough money and buy another house that would be a little bit bigger. And maybe maybe I'd be married at that point, and, you know, maybe I need that more space. I never thought about having a roommate either. It was just too small of a space to have. I mean, in theory, I guess I could, but it just, you know, wasn't laid out in such a way where it made sense. Mm-hmm. Arizona in general is known, as particularly the area that I ended up buying in, was known for retirees and snowbirds. Mm-hmm. And so the condo complex that I actually bought into, I mean, that's where it skewed very, very old. So it was kind of a little bit of a surprise coming from more of a college atmosphere and a much, much younger to, oh, shoot. It was good and bad. So like, you know, most of the people weren't there year round. They just had this as a vacation home. So, you know, during the summer when nobody wants to be there, there really wasn't many people around to, I was super fortunate that my upstairs, so it's a ground floor unit. There's two floors in these condo complexes, that my upstairs neighbor lives in Toronto and is never there. He's, you know, maybe there a couple weeks of the year. And so when he does come, you can definitely hear that he's there. So, if I had heard that, I'm sure I probably would have, you know, not stayed there as long as I did. And looking back on it, how long did I actually stay? Actually, not that long. Probably, again, I'm trying to remember, 3 or 4 years before I, that might be generous, before I moved to San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then decided to keep it and not sell it.
So you decided to keep it and not sell it. Did you, what was the thought process in that? Because I mean, you're then keeping a property that, you know, that you're owning from pretty far away and stuff.
Sure.
Were you renting it out, or what did you do with it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, because it was in a complex that, there was a proven model that people were renting out on short-term basis. It was highly desirable. I was fortunate again to be in a condo complex and not a single family home. I'm sure the economics would look a lot different, on both sides, because appreciation, I don't think, was as high as single family homes, but I didn't have to worry about like a yard and all that stuff was built into the HOA's fee. So really, it was just a matter of getting somebody in there. And I never really considered long-term rentals. It's always been a short-term rental. And the reason was, is just because if I ever wanted to spend time and over the holidays and use it, that I could. What ended up happening, especially when I was in San Francisco, is during the holidays, that's when most people want to go down there. So I actually would either stay with friends or stay back home and never actually got to use it as I've initially envisioned until more recently. So, it was a short-term rental. And so I had a property management company, and they manage all of it. I didn't even want to like pick up the phone whatsoever. So,
and they found the tenants and stuff, or they found the short-term renters as well.
Yeah, exactly. Through whether it be Airbnb, I don't know if they do use Airbnb, but like VRBO, a bunch of other sites. I think even Zillow, like there's just, they put it on every listing that they can, in addition to their own website and people that come in. And this particular property management company they really specialize in short-term rentals. So, and I'd say looking, you know, just over the years, over the last, seven some odd years since I've had it as a rental, it's been about break even. So it'll sit empty about a third of the year, which is surprising because, you know, I'm probably more than half the year, or at least at least half the year. You probably might be uncomfortable if you're not from the area, weather-wise. This, especially at the time of this recording, it's sitting empty, but consistently about one third vacant and then two thirds filled. And then that about covers at least the carrying cost of the property. So, and I think, you know, just reflecting on that, there are other reasons. Like I fully recognize that this money could certainly be doing more than in where it's at, you know, especially recently with the market going really, it doubled in value over the close to 10 years I've had it. So, that's been very helpful, very nice, but, it's only recently that it's really gotten that level of, to that degree. It's because things have been going pretty crazy. But there are other reasons why I'm keeping it. I joke with my parents that this is where they're going to be living when they can't live in their home that they
it's
have.
It's going to be their retirement home.
Exactly. Exactly. So, and oddly enough, I didn't plan it this way, but it's on the first floor. So that, graduating college and just getting into this, that's kind of like the furthest thing from your mind. But apparently old people really like to make sure that it's on the first floor and they're not going up and downstairs. So,
I know that.
Lucked into that.
Yeah, sure. So you've owned that, you still own that, and you still do that today. Cool. Do you own any other property?
Yes. So we no longer live in San Francisco. A lot of different things happened in my life. I was working for a couple startups. I worked for one startup that was allowed me to go remote. So we ended up doing a bunch of Airbnb-ing around. Largely the Pacific Northwest. We didn't get an opportunity to go too far. I quite frankly couldn't keep that level of work because I was working nights and weekends and really couldn't enjoy the remote aspect of it too much other than here and there. But fortunately we were driving up having been a product of the desert and the heat, I knew I wanted to see greenery and maybe the opposite and rain and all that stuff. So ended up finding a home in Portland, Oregon, which is where we're at now. And it's a lot more affordable up here than it is in SF and Seattle even. If we're going to be brutally honest, I would love to have been in Seattle, but just, you know, the Amazons, the Microsofts, all that, that still, you know, and especially there's a lot of people moving up from SF, we just way, way overpriced in the things that we could afford. So, this time around, I knew in the, you know, with having some success, again, I considered, having a property that has enough income to cover the expenses, you know, while not super ideal. And in reality, you'd love to have it cash flow like a lot. I consider that a win. And, to our other points, it's a forced savings as well. But I knew that rates were never going to be this low for that long. So I always, for many, many years, wanted to, for two, three, years, you know, even when I'm in SF, of course, wanted to own more property. I just really like the leveraged effect of it. And so, yeah, just trying to look around, like, what can we find that ticks off all the boxes for us? And so, yeah, I was super fortunate to have found something in Portland.
Okay, so it was really like a, you want to buy a piece of property, like, what can you afford sort of thing. Yeah, had you done any spreadsheets or anything like that, or kind of like,
oh yeah,
yeah, comparing the cost of like renting? And because I'm curious, you'd never lived in Portland before, and so like how quickly did you decide to buy or put an offer in from kind of when you got there? Because it didn't seem like it was a very long time.
No, yeah, you're right. So we had, as I said, we had Airbnb'd in Portland. We were in Seattle. We went over to Montana and went back to Salt Lake City and back to Arizona. Just kind of did a big loop. So we had stayed in Portland for about a month, maybe a month and a half, something like that. It was a big leap, really was, because we ended up, we were looking and I had moved back to Arizona in that condo that I originally bought, when I started my own firm. And then, fortunate that Justine is a remote, and so she's able to work remotely and I work remotely as well. So, we really had the option to, you know, we looked at a lot of different we did a lot of Zillowing. I'm sure like everybody does. Zillow is like, and Google Maps, and trying to triangulate and check all of these, I think it's called Nextdoor and all of these other, like, you know, kind of neighborhood. Not having lived there, I would not recommend my clients do what we did, which was, we bought a house. And so we ended up flying up to check out. I want to say we made an offer on the house
before you even saw it.
And I forgot to mention too, for whatever reason, I wasn't available to see the property that I have in Arizona. So I the condo, and did the same there. So I bought a house, a condo unseen. I bought this house unseen. I take that back, because we actually took a trip and we know we were serious, like, okay, we're not going to spend this amount of money without seeing the darn thing. So we went up and took a look, and thankfully it was as the pictures were, and nothing, no crazy surprises.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Really lucked out.
More adventurous than I thought. Yeah. Exciting.
Yeah. I actually bought a number of cars sight unseen. So I would highly, so do as I say, not as I do. That's definitely the outcome, I think, of this episode here. So very, very much lucked out in a lot of regards.
Cool. Well, yeah. So going through a couple home purchases, like, have we talked about this? Is just like, is there anything that you've learned or things that you wish you knew before you bought them, or just, yeah, other kind of advice for folks who are considering buying a big piece of property? Or I guess, yeah.
Home, yeah.
I guess, say.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, it's definitely making sure that you run the numbers. If you have any inkling whatsoever that you may rent it out, like, what do the actual rents look like today? Are they anywhere near where the housing costs are? I'm sure if I had run those numbers back in the day, I would have been like, I don't think that that's a really good idea. I had no data to go off of whether the condo was going to break even. It was a real stab in the dark, and I was just kind of hoping that things would work out. And frankly, there were some months where it's like, okay, well, I'm taking money from, you know, that I would save or do something else with, and I have to put it into the monthly cost just because there's no income coming in. So definitely making sure that you have, if you're running a rental property, that you've got an emergency fund, just like you do a personal emergency fund, or maybe that's, you know, kind of increased your normal emergency fund. So making sure you can cover all of those bills, because there were definitely some times where I was never between jobs, but, you know, when you're living in San Francisco paying that rent, and, you know, there are those months that it's in the summer and you don't have that really big emergency fund that you should have, I was like, oh man, this, I'm glad there's a renter in there. I'm glad there's a tenant, or, like I'm gonna have to live a little leaner this month or whatever. So, I think in a lot of ways am the exact opposite of how you have approached your, now granted, again, I'm in different markets. So Arizona and Portland, and I'm sure if you were in, not in that area, you might be in a different situation where it may make sense to buy, but, yeah, it seems like the complete opposite, where in some regards you take on leverage. I will say too that on both of the properties, I did not put 20% down.
Mm.
So that's another thing I wanted to share with you. I was doing some research before the call, before our recording this. What do you think the average down payment is for an average American recently?
I don't know. Yeah, I guess. Well, yeah, I guess I don't really have any idea, because the only people I know who bought houses in the Bay Area, and you have to put 20% down or more. I mean, you're going to be. So, yeah, I say 10%, maybe 5%. I guess the question is, like, if you're not putting to 20% and you have to pay private mortgage insurance,
mm-hmm.
like, you're probably putting as little as you possible. Whatever, like, the lender will allow you to do. So, like, what is the minimum lenders will allow you to do? Maybe like 5%. So, I guess 5%.
Wow. Yeah. Your logic kind of holds pretty close. So, it depends on the age range as well. But on average, it's anywhere from 6, and again, depending on where you get the data, 6 to 10 to 12%. So, I know I speak to a lot of clients who are under the impression that you have to have 20% down, but the majority of Americans are not putting down 20%, even though that may be a very good thing to do. Private mortgage insurance. I would imagine that's probably a big business in the US. So, in my first home, again, just given some of right out of college, FHA loan is actually the way I went, which required 3.5%, which was like crazy.
That's like some federally backed loan program or something. What is FHA loan?
Yeah, exactly. That's the Federal Housing Administration.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have a program that allows for folks who qualify. I think it's for folks who don't have great credit or don't have a huge down payment. Or basically have sub 5%. So, and again, this isn't like decades ago. This was probably, this is what 10-ish years from, ago. I didn't find a lender that would do a conventional loan under 5%. So, but there are lenders out there that do that these days. And again, it probably depends on the market. Which is crazy to when you think about it. And at that point in time, I was not doing a bunch of numbers. It was just like, hey, this is the money that I want to put down. And, this is what I want to get into. As long as I can do that and letting the mortgage person tell me that. So I think a lot of people probably approach it that way. It's like, okay, just allow me to get into this. And then I actually, the year that I bought in was the year that FHA didn't allow. So at some point at PMI comes off, and that typically is around the 20% mark, mm-hmm. or the 22.5%. I want to say is like the specific, is your amortization hits that. So you can have some tailwinds where your home value appreciates like crazy. And then you can petition the lender to mm-hmm. remove that. But for whatever reason, the year in which I refinanced, no, I think when I got the loan, FHA standards changed where FHA loan would allow you to remove that at that certain percentage. However, for whatever reason that they changed that, and it's for the life of the loan. So that was pretty crazy, especially as I was doing some of the numbers, like, wait, how much am I paying every month on this? And so I ended up refinancing into conventional loan, mm-hmm. and then changing the term to a 15 year. It was, which drastically increased with the interest rate, it wasn't too crazy when you go from a 30 to a 15, but yeah, it's surprising when you run the numbers. So I think that's really the going long-winded way of saying, like, that's, I think, one of the biggest items is running the numbers. If you're going to rent it out, you know, definitely check to see what those figures are. Know the area too, like, and how long you may be in the area. Like, make sure you feel like you can be there for at least, you know, kind of 3 to 5 years. I'd also, yeah, recommend that you kind of rent place longer, maybe at least 6 months before you jump in. But I also recognize that things can move quickly, and you know, there may be other externalities that may want to influence you, whether it be your kids are going into school, or you know, maybe you're just like on the tail end of a ridiculously low interest rate period, or yeah, I'm sure there's all sorts of things. And that's what's so interesting about home purchases. There's so many different variables that you have to look at or kind of can think about. And a lot of it's emotional. A lot of times people are just looking at the aesthetics and oh, it's imagining your family in there and just like owning the home and nesting and all that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. What you said about knowing the area, that really resonates to me, because I think it's important to like the area that you're in. You know, especially if the area is potentially walkable, I think that makes a big difference. The difference between an area that is where you can walk to do things, to the park or to the grocery store, I think it makes a big difference. You know, obviously, if you're deciding between a bunch of places where you have to drive no matter what, and they're all the same amount of time from grocery store and your office, I guess maybe it doesn't matter as much. But otherwise, yeah, I think, you know, try to get a feel for the area and, you know, look at it kind of at different times of day, different times of, you know, year, if you can, if you just understand how things like traffic or you know, environment, weather. But
you know, what's that, what, like, you, like you're pointing out, like, what's that sacrifice that you want to make? Do you want to be a little bit further away for a little bit more home, maybe that has a backyard? And, you know, how much time are you spending commuting versus, you know, the joys of whatever it is? Do you buy the one that's pretty close to turnkey, or do you buy the one that has, okay, maybe has a couple of things that you want to replace? And And what's that balance between, you know, renovating to getting the very best thing and that you can afford? And yeah, it's really is amazing how this culture is very much like, that's so ingrained. Home ownership is such a staple. I'm sure that harkens back to what is it, the First World War, when folks were coming back from the war and they wanted to. I know it's definitely the Second World War, when you got the, I want to say, Levittowns of the world, of, you know, where it's like these, you know, white picket fence, master plan communities, and you know, just people wanted to live that American dream. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and I just what you said about like sacrificing, and I just find it, I don't quite understand it. Some of the people that I know that have purchased houses and, you know, who really wanted to live in one town or something like that, and when they realized what was out there and what their budget could afford, they bought something that was 40 minutes away from that place, you know, and they had never been there before, never lived there, don't know anything about that. And that just blows my mind. I mean, that's probably a problem pretty, you know, unique to the Bay Area or extremely, extremely high cost of living areas. So yeah, I mean, if that's, you know, if you really need, or you really, really want, you know, something that you can't have and you can't afford, and then it's all just a decision to make. But I think, you know, I recommend people at least get familiar with it. You know, maybe even like rent an Airbnb for a weekend or so there. That's something that's easy. That's something that actually Anna and I have, my wife and I have done a few times, not because we're considering living there, just because we wanted to kind of take a little staycation somewhere. We've, you know, done Airbnbs, just, you know, they're only 45 minutes away from our where we live, but it's far enough away where like we wouldn't normally go there and get breakfast. We wouldn't get an afternoon coffee there. So you can kind of do that and test the place out before committing to it.
Yeah. Yeah. Very good point. Very good point. Yeah. And in the areas, and are you talking about in the Bay Area, or more so kind of a little bit further out into the sticks,
About where people purchased and stuff?
No, where you all went in Airbnb'd.
Oh yeah. We did Airbnb in Oakland a couple years back.
Okay.
A few months ago we did an Airbnb. Oakland's maybe, 30, 40 minutes away. A few months back we did an Airbnb in Martinez, which is like in the East Bay, north side of the East Bay. Uh-huh. Say it's like 40 minutes
away.
What
did you learn in all that? Did you sort of pictured if we bought a home, this is what it would be like? Is that
that was not at all the purpose of it. It was more just we wanted a weekend to just do something different and to stay somewhere else. It's just kind of funny. You just discover parts of a place that you wouldn't otherwise discover for just because you're spending more time in the place and you're doing more things than you would if you were just kind of going there for dinner or spending an afternoon there. Yeah, I don't know. It's kind of a fun activity to do. And it can be really cheap. Martinez is not a poppy. But it turns out there's really not any Airbnbs, actually. I said Airbnb. I couldn't find any Airbnbs in Martinez. We just stayed in a motel. Pretty inexpensive, clean motel. Okay. So
Nice. Yeah, and so I guess my question, and maybe we answered some of that a little bit last episode, but when everybody sort of comes into the world, it seems like kind of ingrained with you have to own property in order to be successful and get a leg up in the world. That's not always the case. Like you ran the numbers and you had the foresight back then to not necessarily jump into. I guess I sort of assume this, but do you think that if you were living in, some other
lower cost of living place?
Yeah. Would you have bought?
Potentially. Yeah. I mean, I think if it was a time when we were planning on living there for a good number of years, 5 or 10 years, and I think potentially. I think, I do start. More recently, I've started to appreciate having space to build things. I've always really been interested in kind of building and kind of tinkering on things. So having
a workshop
or a garage, and not that you have to buy something to do that. But so that is something. So yeah, I think if we were planning on living somewhere for 5 or 10 years, for sure. But I don't know if we'll ever have, I don't know, there's so many incredible places in the world, and hopefully he'll have the flexibility to be able to really choose where we want to live and not be tied to a location for work and stuff. So, I don't know if and when that will happen, but, I think I'm totally open to it. I'm not anti-owning property and things. It's just, I think it has to make financial sense as well as just lifestyle, make also be good for our lifestyle too.
Mm-hmm. And a couple more questions. So did you, when you both had Isla, did you think about was there any sort of instinctual nesting that occurred or was that still kind of thinking through the more financial lens of, does this make sense?
That's a good question. I don't necessarily think so. I think I felt like the place we had. When I was born, we had a 2-bedroom apartment in San Francisco. There was nothing that I felt like it was inadequate for. I mean, I think now as she's getting older and has more energy, and we want to teach her how to ride a balance bike, for instance. So I kind of understand the idea of having more space per se, but I guess where we live now, we have some community kind of garden areas and stuff, but where we were living, we were a one block away from a really nice park, on one side we had to always walk a block or two, but the park that was there was huge, and we could just walk there. Now we live in a place where walking is not that great. It's not really a sidewalk on our street. Kind of have to drive everywhere. but the property of our building has more amenities and stuff. So I think it's just kind of pros and cons, really. I don't really think there's anything in that when you have kids, you have to have a backyard. I think there's benefits for sure. But I think, it also, us not having a backyard sort of forces all of us to go out, you know, like almost every weekend in the morning, we'll all go out for a walk together, you know?
Oh, nice.
And so it is kind of forcing, like, we know we need to get her out of the house to release some energy, and mm-hmm. it forces us to get out of the house too. Whereas maybe if we had a backyard, we would just, you know, open the door and say, tell her to go play and stuff. So in some ways, I think having a small house, this is, you know, kind of forces you to spend more time
together,
you know, outside. Yeah. Maybe, I guess you're right. Yeah, together too. I didn't think about that so much, but yeah, it forces you time to spend more outside, maybe in your community or just outdoors. And so I like that. Yeah.
And my last question is, if for those who've been listening to a lot of episodes, we touched on financial independence, the FIRE. I guess, well, they call them, it's probably an old phrase, but FIRE movement. You know, that's something that's very important to you. Do you see it as? I think I know the answer here, but I'll ask anyways. But was it always like, this goal is above, say, homeownership if it didn't make sense financially?
That's a good question. I think it's a balance. You know, I think both Anna and I both being aligned as to like we wanting to, you know, retire early has sort of, I think, has made the idea of not buying a house just easier to digest, and it makes more sense because it's consistent with that goal. But again, like if we, you know, if we could buy a house and then buy a you know, that had a lot more things that we really wanted, and maybe it delayed our plans by 6 months or a year, like I think we would consider that, you know. But I don't think that's really the case in our current situation. So yeah, I think it's flexible. I think it's really just, it's a balance, right? It's like, you know, how much do you want to optimize for which part of your time right now, right? Like we could decide to, you know, maybe work a little bit less right now, and then it would take us longer to reach that financial independence. Or we could, you know, again, spend more, have more luxuries, or have a nicer house, and again, maybe delay that. Or we could, you know, really cut our expenses, which is something we kind of talked about, but we decided we didn't really want to do that. We could cut our expenses and retire even sooner. So it's not like financial independence is the ultimate goal, and we're doing everything is like, and like trying to optimize and shorten, make that goal sooner, closer and sooner as possible. That's not the case for us. It really is a balance. And so it has to be something that you can stick with, I think is important. Again, like, kind of like a, I don't know, it's a good example, like a diet or mm-hmm. if you have to have a plan, you need to have something that I think is
more healthy,
is yeah, realistic healthy. that you can actually continue to do and to stick to, because otherwise, you know, there's no point in having a plan if you can't really stick to it. So, you know, you'll kind of change things over time, but just, you know, figuring out what works for you at the given time.
Wow. Yeah, that's amazing. And I really wanted to delve into that. I'm maybe there's probably more to say on all of that, those different choice points. But certainly, well, very wise beyond your years, Lauren, for not falling into the housing trap of, you know, just trying to rush in to get something and take a second thought. Cause you truly have the optionality of going wherever you want after this, you know. I guess the only thing that's keeping you in, and even that you can break, is the lease, or maybe it's the, you know, when the school year or something like that, when that gets going.
Our apartment building sent us a lease renewal letter, and actually decided just to stay month to month and to pay, I think, like $150 for the privilege of doing that. So
that's
how kind of uncommitted we are to where we are now. Even. So, I think they offered like $100 less or $150 less per month if we signed a 12-month lease. But there's no, I mean, if you decided to leave and break, you just have to pay through the end. So, you know, you save $100 a month, but if there was even like a 10% chance we want to leave before the end, I mean, you know, if we sacrifice a month's rent, that's, you know, $3,000. So I actually don't claim to have done math there. I could probably do some simple math, but it just feels like, I mean, we like the place we are, but, you know, it's, I would like to be in a place that's a little more walkable personally, but I haven't found anything for rent in and like that. So, yeah.
Wow. Yeah. So it's $1,800 a year that you're if you were to stay there for the full year. But it sounds like, again, you have that optionality and that you have an actual price to say, this is what I value my flexibility.
Yeah.
And something that could be that could keep people in one place, which is definitely their home. Well, in closing here, I don't know if there's any sort of lessons or things that I can speak to other than I've done things almost the complete opposite way that I normally recommend folks do. And for a lot of, a lot of my conversations with clients, it's like, I'm just a data point that I can give you. And, maybe I'll help give some data points of some other clients that what they do and some friends and family and all that stuff. So, try to make as smart of financial decisions as you can. And obviously there are other externalities that may force you to do, for example, just like if you have an aging parent and they have nowhere to go and maybe you are able to, you're looking at buying a house and that kind of sways your decision. I mean, there's just so many different factors that people are trying to solve for. So, that go beyond just, again, what the numbers may make sense for in one particular, if you're trying to optimize to the nth degree. So it can be challenging, but there is a takeaway, I suppose. It's like, yeah, we're all human. We're not robots. We're not all making the perfect financial, except if you're Lauren, you're making the perfect. I'm joking, of course. So anything else, any closing words on your end there, Lauren? As I take a parting jab,
just try to do what's right for you. Don't let someone else or
society
tell you what to do. Just kind of figure out what you think is good for you. And I think I try to run the numbers. Find we'll share some resources of kind of how to do that. Just understand the cost of other different options. And again, you don't have to do the thing that is going to put you ahead financially, but just be aware of what that cost might be.
Well said. Yeah. And if you haven't done so, definitely go back and listen to our, this is what you should do. This is the, do as I say. And then this episode is more as the, not as I do. So, definitely check out. There's a lot of good resources that we shouted about on that one. And as always, I'm curious to hear your stories. Is there any fun real estate stories of you bought a duplex or, a quadplex or, and you had instant income out and you made you're able to have your cake and eat it, or any horror stories of trying to flip houses like it's 2005 or whatever. Let us know. Feedback at maxfinancepodcast.com. That's feedback at maxfinancepodcast.com. Thanks for listening, everybody, and we'll see you next time. We're a new podcast, and it would mean the world to us if you took a moment to write a review in the Apple Podcasts app or share this episode with a friend or family member. We'd like to hear from you. Is there a topic you're interested in? Have feedback more generally? Email us at feedback@maxfinancepodcast.com. Thanks, and see you next time.